everyone, to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 209. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me, as always, John Lindemann.
A.K.A. your DJ hero.
No.
Greg Lay.
Hello.
And James Jones.
Hi.
All right. We are here to talk some Metroid at you, or at least three of us are.
I'm here to sleep during that conversation.
Yes, and we are going to... Metroid Other M is like the biggest thing to ever happen to this podcast, and we're going to get into it in a minute. But first,
that's a horrible statement. Terrible.
I want to give a timely current event shout-out to Junior Librarian, or JR Librarian, I don't know how you say it, who is at PAX... At the time that this episode is coming out, in the future, PAX should be wrapping up around the time this episode is launched, and I'm hoping that he will hear this on his way home from PAX, because this guy sent me a forum PM a few days ago asking for permission to share an idea of mine at the Penny Arcade Expo in Seattle, at the PAX Prime. There is a panel called Pitch Your Game Idea. And I think you have like 15 or 30 seconds to just throw an idea out there, and it's literally like shouting it to a room. Like once it's out there, it's out there.
Dick monsters.
Anybody can do whatever they want to it. It's basically a no copyright zone, okay? And he asked my permission if he could pitch Theremin Hero, which was devised and announced on Radio Free Nintendo way back in, boy, I think it was episode 80 or...
It's season 1, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's before before I was hosting, actually.
Yeah.
So yeah, it might be 60. It's like a round number like that, 60 or 80. Anyway. Yeah,
it's in the twilight of the first age.
Well, the feature topic for that episode was our dream games, and that was the one where Carl described his dream
game. Sin and
plagiarism.
That's what it's called, Sin and Plagiarism. That's the name of the episode, if you want to
go
back.
Yes. Carl did not realize that his dream game had already been made. It's called Sin and Punishment.
And apparently it's the same as my dream game.
Right. He couldn't believe it. I was like, you know this game already exists, right? He's like, what? Yeah, you should go play it. So anyway, Junior Librarian is pitching Theremin Hero at PAX, and I'm so excited. He's like, are you okay with this? I was like, hell yes, I'm okay with it. Put it out there, man. So if there are any other RFN listeners who attended this panel, who attended PAX, and you heard it, I hope you shouted out something awesome, and I hope you shook that man's hand. And I hope it worked out. And I hope someone makes it, although that's not really the point of that panel. But
or if he didn't shout it out, rat his ass out and we will deride him.
Well, I'm sure there's a bit of competitiveness in terms of, you know, there's
you
a lot of people who want to say something.
You tackle that fucker with the microphone and you say what you need to say.
Exactly. All right. So anyway, just wanted to get that out there. Anybody who went to PAX, hope you had a good time. Hope you did not get the swine flu. I wish we had been there. We looked into getting a panel, and it didn't work out, unfortunately, but we are going to try again in March for PAX East 2. So more details to come in a few months on that. Hopefully things will work out that time. Now it's time for new business, and of course the big new release this week is Metroid Other M. This is a rare case where three out of the four of us have played the same game, and not only the same game, but a timely game, a brand new exclusive Wii game. It's the first Metroid game released in 3 years, and the first Japanese-developed Metroid game released in about 5 or 6 years. So
six and a half, Zero Mission. Really?
Yeah. So anyway, Metroid Other M, it's a big deal. And it's a very controversial game, and I know a lot of people are very eager to hear what we think about it. So, John, I want to start with you, because you've probably played the least of it, but we can all share our first impressions, and then I probably played the most of it, so I can get a little deeper into it as well later on.
Yeah, I've played into Sector 1, so I'm kind of going through the biosphere. I haven't gotten to the boss yet. I didn't really have any problem adjusting to the controls at all. I think that the kind of free-range camera control with the Wii Remote, it's a little bit annoying because it kind of takes you out of gameplay a bit. But one of the first things I thought was that I wasn't having any problems with the controls. And I think one of the reasons why that is because of me already playing Shadow Complex, which kind of makes you adjust. It's the same sort of thing where it's like a 2D platformer, and it kind of feels weird at the start because you don't have total control over what you're shooting at. But Shadow Complex really kind of got me used to that, so...
Well, I think there's some similarities, John, mm-hmm. but at the same time, Shadow Complex is a strictly 2D movement game.
True.
So you can shoot in 3D, kind of, but the depth targeting happens automatically. Mm-hmm. What doesn't happen automatically is you actually use the right stick in Shadow Complex to aim your laser sight around the room. And you can't even really do that in Metroid. Samus just shoots in that direction and she'll auto-aim.
There is some auto-aiming in Shadow Complex, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, you're definitely right about that. But you can pinpoint shoot as well, and you can't even really do that in Metroid without going into first person.
True.
But I've thought about Shadow Complex a lot while playing this game.
Yeah.
In that there are certain ways in which Shadow Complex is more Metroid-y than other M.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily saying it's a better game, it's a different game.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me that... And I wonder if people at Team Ninja and Nintendo looked at Shadow Complex and said, well, we gotta compete with this, you know, we gotta do something different and try to do something better. I don't know.
It was interesting. I thought that in the one interview that we posted the other day with Sakamoto, he said that his goal was to create effectively a next generation NES game, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. So I kind of like it was interesting because I read all of that and I saw that interview. So I kind of went into playing the game with that in mind. So maybe I took it with a grain of salt more than other people would. Like if you probably would have just told me nothing about that game and said, here's the new Metroid game, go and play it, and told me nothing about the background of it, nothing about why they chose to make the voice acting this way or whatever. I think probably to me, I'm probably just because I've kind of heard a little bit of the backstory of the game, I'm probably maybe a little bit easier on it, or maybe I kind of knew sort of what to expect, so it's not as jarring for me.
Greg, first impressions.
Yeah, well, this actually showed up a couple of days early for me, so I've managed to get in about 4 hours game time, a decent amount, more than I was expecting. But yeah, I mean, for me, again, yeah, like John, I was very well prepared for what the game was going to be. And I had, of course, played it at the London E3 event, which was, you know, basically the start of the game. So I was, you know, very well prepared for that. And the controls, I kind of, you know, got my head around them fairly quickly. I think for me, the best thing about the D-pad controls is that it gives the game a kind of nice quick twitch kind of feel. When you're dodging around the place and, you know, just changing directions. And the environments are very angular, and there's a certain amount of auto adjustment if you're going around curved corridors. So you pretty much just, you know, only sort of press in one direction a lot of the time. So I didn't have any problems with that. But in terms of the first person thing, I've kind of oscillated on that somewhat. I think there was a sort of period where I was getting used to it, which was a bit awkward. Then I kind of got to like it quite a lot. And then the kind of the novelty's worn off a little bit, and maybe I'm going back the other way. I mean, I think it generally works, and you are kind of managing it a little bit. You know, I mean, the key for me is that when you first go into that first person mode, that first moment where the view shifts, everything slows down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you've got time to find your target, lock on, and launch a missile in the heat of battle. And the best policy that I've kind of adopted is if I can't get done what I want to get done immediately after that little bit of extra time that they give you, just check out of it and start again. Don't stand there while everything's going on full speed around you, because that's not really a good idea. So it definitely adds to the tension at times, you know, when you feel that, yeah, you know, I've got to get this right in that split second or whatever when it first comes up. But I mean, it can be a little bit frustrating as well, but certainly I feel warmer about it than a lot of the things I've read.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I miss is, and I think it's kind of a missed opportunity for the game overall, is that even though you can go into this first person perspective, you can't scan anything. That's one of the things I really, really enjoyed from the Metroid Prime series that I wish they would have brought over.
You can identify things, like if there's a door that needs a super missile to blow up, and you know, there'll be a little thing on it, you can lock onto it and it'll scan it for a second and say super missile. So it tells you what you need to unlock it.
Yeah, I feel like
there's no like encyclopedia type stuff.
Yeah, I feel like they kind of gave you the opportunity to look around, to just stand back for a second and look around. And actually, because, I mean, the game looks really, really good, and the environments look great. But, you know, there's really nothing to... I mean, you can go into this first-person perspective, but beyond just finding out what you can hit with a missile, there's not really much you can do with it. I just wish they would have taken that extra step and kind of provided even more backstory, maybe just on...
Well, there's plenty of backstory.
With movies, yeah, but I just wish that there would have been kind of like maybe like the fact that you couldn't sit there and, you know, scan your ship. And so one of the things I always liked from the Prime games is you could, right when you start... you jump off of your ship and just go running. But if you turned around, you could sit back and scan your ship and it says, this is this kind of ship, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, I think the problem is, obviously that stuff, a lot of that's always been optional in the Prime games, but I wonder about, if it's a weird one because the gameplay with the D-pad, like I said, quite quick twitch, everything, it flows quite fast, but then it's interrupted by cutscenes and it's interrupted by kind of looking around. And I don't know how willing I'd be to stop and scan stuff in this one.
Yeah.
And we're kind of like eager for it to get on with it when the going's good.
Yeah, I guess my perspective is they're doing it anyways, so
I'm okay with the removal of scanning, actually, because I'm the kind of person where, even though it's optional, if it's in there and the stuff is interesting to read, I'm gonna do it. Mm-hmm. And one of the side effects of doing that in the Prime games is that it really slows the pace down a lot.
Even further, yeah.
Even more. And those games are not super fast anyway. And Metroid Other M is clearly designed to be played very, very fast. I think Sakamoto's NES comparison is a valid one. It plays at the speed of like the original Ninja Gaiden, which Greg discussed last week. And it plays at the speed of Ninja Gaiden on Xbox, which I have. And that reminds me a lot of that in terms of the character movement, the way Samus jumps makes a lot of sense. And the environment design. The environment design's more complex, more sophisticated in Other M than it was in Ninja Gaiden. But even in Ninja Gaiden, I could see the way those places were put together, and you can see a lot of the DNA of Other M in that game. So, I guess if you're a fan of Ninja Gaiden, the reboot on Xbox, then, or Ninja Gaiden 2 on 360 or PS3 or whatever, you have a good idea of what to expect here. Plus Metroid. But I've played a little over 8 hours now, so there's going to be some stuff that I won't get into. We'll talk about this more next week, and we can get into some of the late game stuff. I could probably review it right now. I'm very close to the end of the story, and was very heartened by Zach Miller's review when he noted that there's a lot of post game content. So basically, you don't have to worry about, oh, am I almost to the end? I need to go back and get that missile thing. You can just play through it, beat the boss. After the credits roll, you can go back and you can go and explore all that stuff. And then apparently there's a bonus boss that's much better that is unlocked once you kind of get all the other stuff that you missed before. So the game really seems to open up a lot after the main story has concluded. I think I'm almost to that point now where it kind of flips over. But, I think the difference between Zach and myself is that Zach didn't really like everything up to the post-game content.
No. Saying he didn't like it is like saying Hitler wasn't a very nice man.
Zach was pretty harsh on it. I'm not going to compare him to Hitler, but that's your prerogative, James.
I didn't compare him to Hitler. I said he's...
You compared understatements.
Yes.
So, No, I see all of his points, and I can see how they're very subjective things. I mean, some people are going to have a bigger problem with these elements than I do. The things like the story, which the story itself is okay, and the voice acting, actually, I'm pretty much okay with. It's not great, but it's not terrible. And I can see what, you know, the woman who plays Samus, I can see what she's going for, and I think she's doing it deliberately.
Yep.
The problem is the writing.
It's awful.
She's given nothing to do, and unfortunately, Samus's lines of dialogue are 2 to 3 times longer than they need to be. There's just too many words there to paraphrase inaccurately Bill O'Reilly, but the writing is really overdone. It's just way too much. They use just too much exposition.
Yeah, exposition is the key word. I mean, I felt this way after I played it at the London event, but certainly playing into it more. If you remember, when they put up the Japanese teaser site for this, I thought they were going for a kind of a Blade Runner kind of vibe. because, you know, the futuristic golden skyline and the lonely piano music and everything. And the final game is reminding me of Blade Runner as well, but not in a good way. And this is because younger people might not remember the original version of Blade Runner, the theatrical version before the director's cut.
I saw it when I was young.
Which had a bunch of voiceover lines that were added by the studio because they thought certain things were not clear. They needed to kind of, you know, explain all this crazy crap that was going on. And so you ended up with these appalling lines of exposition delivered deliberately badly by Harrison Ford because he didn't believe
it. Because he didn't
want to
do it.
Where he says, like, skin job was another name for replicant. You know?
Yeah,
and
no, it's that kind of stuff. A lot of the writing in Other M is stuff that you can already figure out by just paying attention to the movie. Yep. It just doesn't need to be there. It's redundant.
It is exactly that. And you know, some of it as well, not just in terms of explain, but it's just, I mean, it's appalling writing in any absolute
and
sense.
And the lip syncing, sure. My God.
I don't care about lip syncing.
It looks terrible in some parts, though.
I mean, just at the very beginning, you're assaulted with the baby's cry. This distressing, there was codename this to give it the urge of a baby crying.
Yeah.
Right.
What?
The training part at the beginning is awful, too.
Yeah.
That's great, Samus. Why don't you shoot that? It's like, oh.
Isn't that Nate Bilbilf or something? Isn't that one of the...
Probably. Poor Nate. I like Nate. He's a good guy, but... you know, I think the days of Dan Osen saying, "The last Metroid is in captivity." Let's, you know... Come on, Nintendo, you're a big company now. You got lots of money. This is a big game. Costs millions of dollars to make. Maybe you should spend a little more money on your localization and your production. And that's the sad thing to me about the story, because I don't know how accurate the translation is here of the script, but regardless, it seems to me that there was an opportunity to either write a completely new script or just improve whatever the original Japanese is. And that wasn't done. It's weird because you look at a lot of other Nintendo games and the localization, it seems like it's been getting better and better and better over the past 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. And to the point where I feel like the Treehouse is one of the better and most respected localization studios in the world. And yet, Other M comes along, it's like, holy shit, guys, who wrote this?
Yeah.
What were you thinking? If it is this bad in the Japanese, then you should have done something about it. A lot of, 50% of the script is Samus narrating with no lip sync, which means you can do whatever you want with it. You can you could strip out 90% of the words, and it's not going to affect what's on the screen. So do that, please. You should have done that, because this is way too much. It's just totally
I can only assume they just, whether it came to them as a kind of diktat or whether it was on their own kind of discretion that they wanted to respect Sakamoto's original intent. You know,
it comes across as like bad fan fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's really a shame, because I think the rest of the game's great. I really like Other M. You know, I'm not done with it. I haven't seen everything, but I got the screw attack, which means I'm pretty damn far. I really like the gameplay. I think the writing is the biggest problem of the game. So if that stuff doesn't bother you, and honestly, it doesn't bother. I mean, I can harp on it because it is hilariously bad.
Yeah, it's funny to do so, but I really couldn't give a shit, to be honest.
Yeah, I couldn't either, really.
Generally, things like that don't really affect
my
enjoyment.
It's a very legitimate criticism of the game.
Totally.
I've certainly seen reviews. Zach felt, you know, really bad about it, and there's Phil Kohler's review for Game Informer. It was really Samus-centric sort of review of the game.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you can't really blame them for taking it badly, because they obviously, you know, it was a big part of the effort of making the game, and it's awful.
No, I get that. But, you know, I'm just not the kind of person who places that much stock into the actual characters of Nintendo franchises.
Especially Metroid.
Yeah, I mean, especially Metroid. But even to go to Mario, for instance, the actual character design of Mario has very little nostalgic or any other kind of value for me. When I think of Mario, I think of the level designs. I think of the feel of the jumping. I think of the music.
Yeah,
a lot more than I think
amusing.
Of this fat plumber guy with a mustache. And Metroid is the same way. It's about the gameplay. It's about the game design. It's
the
about
world.
All the things that make Metroid unique. Samus Aran is barely a character before this week. I mean, she barely exists as a character at all. And Sakamoto apparently wasn't satisfied with that and wanted to build her up into something a lot more fleshed out. And I think he did it poorly, but at the same time, I didn't care before, and I still kind of don't care.
Yeah, it's like stuff I didn't really care about the story. I didn't really want it anyways, so they're giving me extra.
And the movies are really pretty.
Yeah.
So that's I'm cool with the movies. I think this game really could have benefited from just a better localization, and I think the reviews would be a lot more positive if more care had been taken in the localization. But in the end, I don't care that much because I do like the game a lot. The controls, I'm very used to them after 8 hours. I still think that the game would play better with a nunchuck, and I think that should have been an option at the very least. But I can deal. It stopped bothering me after an hour or two. I mean, it's not like I didn't think about it anymore, because you have to think about it. That's how you play the game. There's a lot of very physical moving the controller back and forth, especially in boss battles. You're doing it a lot. And it can be frustrating occasionally, but in general, it works quite well. And most of the game you play NES style, which is the better half of the control scheme. So I love the speed of it. Yeah. I really love the speed. I mean, after coming off Metroid Prime, all three of those, the difference in pacing and just the agility of Samus as you run around, the speed at which you can move from room to room is really remarkable. And, you know, one of the really interesting things to me is that you no longer have to shoot doors to open them. They just open when you get near them.
Yeah.
And that really, it makes the game feel more seamless. It makes it feel like you're just moving through these things. It doesn't feel so segmented off like the Prime games tend to do and all the previous Metroid games do. So I think that's a turn for the better. The jumping is wonderful, the platforming. Now, there are some of the more open 3D rooms have platforming in them that can be frustrating because of the trying to choose your angles with the D-pad. And sometimes, you know, it is a fixed camera, so sometimes the perspective just isn't quite right for you to do what you want to do. But those are rare circumstances, and especially in the 2D parts of the game, which is a large portion of the game, the jumping just works really well. It feels great. I don't want to spoil too much for anybody, but I mean, obviously you get the screw attack in this game. You get it in all the Metroid games. And once you get the screw attack and the space jump, it feels so different from Prime. It feels so much more like Super Metroid. It's unbelievable. And it gets to a point where it feels like I'm basically playing a Super Metroid or Zero Mission on the Wii with damn near high definition graphics. I mean, they look HD, even if they're not. The game looks so good.
I love the animation as well. The animation's really expressive.
It is, yeah. And it gets better and better as you go, I think. And it gets to a point where it honestly does feel like those old NES and Super NES and GBA games, but in 3D and on the Wii. You know, when I was a kid, when I was doing The Informant, 17, 18 years old, back in high school, and I first started writing about Nintendo, I had this entire page devoted to Metroid 64, and I was collecting all the rumors, all the information we could get, all the public, you know, all the official comments from Miyamoto and people like that. And at that time, this is basically the game that existed in my mind for what I thought Metroid 64 would be. Except now it looks a lot better than it would have back then.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the game is perfect, but I would love to see them do another game like this and maybe kind of clean it up a bit. I think it could be something really spectacular.
Absolutely. If you look at the advancement between Fusion and Zero Mission, which are one year apart.
Yeah, just a little more than a year, yeah.
Same engine, same development team. But if you look at just the refinement of Zero Mission and everything that they clearly learned from doing Fusion, I would love to see that happen again with Other M, because I think Other M has pretty much all the fundamentals are right, and there's a couple of little things in polish, there's a couple little design choices that probably need to be cleaned up, needs a better script.
Or less. I would settle for less.
To me, this game is like 90% of the way there to being a great, really great canon Metroid game. I think this engine and this game design that they have would be fantastic for a remake of Metroid 2. I would love to see that.
I mean, one thing I would add to the sort of the pacing point, I mean, obviously you've got the issue of, you know, the movement and all that, but the boss battles, I think, is really what I've enjoyed the most so far. Yeah. And that's because They certainly play more like 2D Metroid game bosses than the 3D ones, because the Prime bosses are so slow.
Well, and the Prime bosses are events. I mean, you know that you're going to the boss room.
There's a giant room.
there's a big movie, and then you scan it, and it tells you the weak point, and it goes through these different stages. And in Other M, it just kind of, you walk into a room, and this thing starts attacking you, and you don't know how to beat it. You just have to start shooting and dodging and go. And then it's dead. And you don't know what it was called. You can't scan its corpse to get bonus points. It's there. You have to kill it. It's like survival. It's really
intense.
I hate the word visceral. Yeah, intense is better. It's very intense. It's very, and it just, sometimes they even pop out of corridors and stuff. Sometimes they'll just like surprise attack you, and you didn't know that you were going to be fighting a boss, but now you are. You better kill it.
But I would also say, I think in general, at least the ones I've played so far, you know, they tend to be a little more kind of tricky and challenging than a lot of Metroid bosses. I mean, probably more on, you know, appropriate enough on par with Fusion, which I think had some of the sort of more complicated and challenging bosses that you've seen in a sort of Sakamoto Metroid game. But a lot of the best Metroid Prime bosses are the ones that are clever. And then the other was a kind of wars of attrition. Whereas these are exciting. And for me, that is a really big part of recapturing some of what's best about earlier Metroid games. But in an even more interesting way now, with the kind of, you know, the how agile Samus is in a 3D environment and the tension of having to use the missiles and all this. You know, it feels fresh as well.
You know, there's a really interesting thing about this game. There's no health pickups. There's no energy balls.
Yeah, no grinding for health.
No. You either get to a save point and refill everything, or you can refill some of your energy and all of your missiles by holding up the remote and holding down A. And that becomes a very interesting mechanic as you get deeper into the game.
It's more tension again.
Yeah, you can do it really, really tactically, especially if you get your ass kicked. You're like, wait a minute. Let's see what kind of shots I can get.
Normally, I mean, the way it's been for me is normally you get a window for hitting something with a missile. Mm-hmm. And that's where you can pick your spot to not hit it with the missile and recharge your health.
And the interesting thing is, once your energy gets knocked down to zero, it'll go back up to one. So the game intentionally gives you one last chance. But you gotta dodge like crazy and go find a safe spot, or just wait for a window in the boss pattern so that you have just exactly the 3 seconds I need to recharge so I can keep fighting, or else you're totally screwed. And it makes for some very, very gripping boss battles. It's good shit.
But you don't have to go all the way back to a save point. It's got like a checkpoint system, you know.
Right.
So it's been, you know, adapted around that change of getting rid of the whole grind for health system that's been in, you know, every Metroid game. So,
and that, again, it just improves the pace of the game. You no longer have to fill up all your reserve tanks and, you know, all
go,
that
go
kind of stuff.
Go to find an enemy fountain and then fill up.
Kill one at a time.
I like that change.
Yeah,
definitely.
It's great. It's very thoughtful. I mean, there's some really good stuff in here. And on the whole, I think it does really feel like a Metroid game. And again, it feels more like a Metroid game the deeper into it you play. The other nice thing I can give you guys a preview is that, and Greg, you're right in the area at about 4 hours where the cutscenes kind of go away for a while and you just get to play the game for a while.
Yeah.
And that's really nice. And the flow of the game structure really improves kind of in the middle there. And, you know, you get some more movies as you get closer to the end. But also in the beginning, it can feel like it takes a really long time for them to give you new upgrades or for them to authorize you, which is so stupid. It's really stupid story conceit, but it essentially works the same as all the other Metroid games in that, you know, you get to a certain place or you kill a certain boss and you get an upgrade. It's just a matter of how they handle it in the story.
Picky contrivance at this point, and this one is spectacularly contrived.
Oh, it is. But mechanically, it works the same way. But what's nice is that the pace at which you get upgrades seems to accelerate as you go through the game. And it gets to a point where I've been playing today, I think I got 3 upgrades in less than an hour of playing. So, and they were major upgrades, major. So it does start to feel like, oh, you know, shit's getting real. So I'm going to need more firepower, it's so cool. I mean, even though she's just turning on something that she's already got with her, it still feels really cool when you get an upgrade. And they're a lot of fun to use. there aren't really any new upgrades, I would say, which is, it's a bugaboo for me. I mean, I hate that. Yeah. I want them to get creative. I want them to add new elements to the game. And they haven't really done that with other M. But what they have done is they've really focused on the powers and the abilities of Samus that can be used in the action of playing the game. So there's not really anything that feels like a glorified or an abstracted key. Because there aren't really keys in this game. It's more directed than that. It's more like fusion. So basically, there's usually one place where you need to go, and the map will tell you basically how to get there. So it's not so much a matter of you figuring out the path. And that happens a few times, but mostly it's just, okay, I need to go in that direction. And it's just a matter of, can you survive? Can you get through all of this stuff? And can you find a few missile upgrades that are hidden on the way? Anyway, we've talked enough about it for now. James is asleep, probably.
Hallelujah.
And now we're going to talk about some different games. But if you have been paying attention and interested in this conversation, and you have a question for us about the game or a comment from your time playing it, something you want to share, something maybe we can talk about in terms of where does the series go from here, send those to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and we'll try to get to some of those next week when we come back to it and sort of wrap up our prime chunk of Metroid Other M talk. So, James, we haven't heard from you in a while. Why don't you tell us what you've been playing?
I'm going to bore the shit out of everybody, but I don't care anymore.
We just bored the shit out of you, so it's,
return
it's
the favor,
turn.
My man.
More than you could ever imagine. I have been playing a complete, so it's 100% fan translation of the Tales of Innocence, which is one of the three Tales games that came out on the DS that we never got. This one was 2007, I think. So there was one more recently that came out in like 2009. The interesting thing about this translation is how, first off, it's really, really good. Like, amazingly good.
Like, better than Namco's official translations.
It's probably,
how could it not be, is my question.
It's probably at the very least on par with what they would have done officially if they put this game out. There's a lot of shit to translate. I mean, they translated everything. Like, even the garbage the characters spout in battles, they translated. And like there's a little text at the top of the screen that I don't know if there was Japanese text there before or not, but there's a little text at the very top of the screen what they're saying. Not that you have time to read it, because the game's battles actually are very analogous to the console ones, which is a nice touch, because most of the handheld games of the series have all had simple battle systems. But, you know, it's an interesting game. It does a good job of bringing what the last 6 years of the series has been on the console to the DS, which, you know, it's a limited platform. It's only got so much power. It's only got so much storage. You can only do so much with it. It's got about as much voice acting as the GameCube games did, which
wow.
is a lot of fucking voice acting.
Wow.
It's got infinite mountains of dialogue, which which if I were still playing it in Japanese would be impossible. I mean, the game physically cannot be played. So the dialogue is still all in Japanese. The voices are, obviously, but the text is in English. The combat system, like I said, is a full console port of the combat system, which actually works really well once you get the buttons down.
So is Tales of Innocence significantly different from Tales of Symphonia?
No, it's not.
I know it's a JRPG, and they, you know, I mean, I'm a fan of Dragon Quest. They're obviously pretty much all the same, but
it's not. And I think that's its major accomplishment, is that they pulled that off on a DS versus a lot of the Tales games that have come out, even on the PSP, that are more simplified games.
Okay, fair enough.
The first Tales game that came out, I can't on the DS, I don't remember what it was called, but it's somewhat reviled for its simplicity and its terrible story. I mean, by Tales standards, terrible story. I mean,
even flying yeah. still might be better than other M stories, James.
It might be. I don't think I have to imply it. But what this particular game, I won't go into too much detail, because it's a Tales game from basically the GameCube games downported to a DS game.
You've been on a hell of a kick on Tales games lately. You seem to be, I mean, a pretty big fan.
I played three this year, and I've
That's
played.
Scary. I know there's a lot of them, but damn,
there's like 13. Yeah,
he's not the RPG guy.
No, he's the Tales guy.
I enjoy those games though because the battle
too general, John.
I know exactly. The battle systems are so much faster than the average RPG's battle system. I mean, they're like brawlers when you actually get into combat, which for me is fine because I don't want to sit there and go, okay, now you need to use this spell and then you need to attack.
Menu.
Makes a difference to me enjoying RPG, even someone who doesn't play very many. Like, difference between playing like Chrono Trigger and FF4 on DS. Chrono Trigger always feels a bit more pleasurable.
It's a lot faster.
Everything goes so much faster.
And except for boss battles, battles almost never last a minute. I mean, right. we're like hard battles against regular enemies are like 48 seconds.
You will like FF13.
Yeah,
it's
really
very
quick.
Fast-paced. Yep. Very fast battles.
What's weird about this game, though, is that you can see the concessions that were made for downporting it to the DS. So there's some weird interface quirks that can be kind of irritating. Every Tales game that I could think of has always told you what town you're about to enter by putting like a little prompt over the screen as you walk up to it, but this game doesn't because I guess it's rendering so much for the 3D world, which isn't a huge deal once you because there's only a handful of towns, which is another concession for the game. But still, it's interesting. The AI though is where the game really kind of struggles under the weight of processing, because your ally AI is not good. It's much worse than the GameCube and Xbox games, because in that case they generally care that you're about to die. Or in this game, they might care unless they're busy getting themselves killed. Which, generally speaking, they're busy getting themselves killed. So you have to babysit them a lot. But so, what the game does is it gives you these prioritized instructions. So, like, your primary priority is to keep the party healed. Your secondary priority is to attack what I'm attacking. Your tertiary is to keep yourself healed. And then your quantary is to stay the hell out of danger. They generally speaking, ignore those except for ones like, you put use items as like their fifth priority, like the very bottom. Like, I'm going to use all your items now. And you're like, well, great. Thank you, game. Now I'm fucked. And the level design isn't as good as some of its bigger brothers, which means it's a lot more generic levels, which means the textures aren't quite as good. A lot of reused sections, which means you get lost really badly. Versus the other games, which are very, you know, they have that very distinct cel shading style, and there's lots of detail, and you can make visual notes like, okay, I've seen that decorative object before. I know I've already been in this room. Whereas in this, it's basically like just big open spaces, and you don't know if you've been here before, or you're lost. I spent 2 nights wandering the same dungeon because I got lost, and I couldn't find the way out in either direction.
Your patience, James, really boggles the mind.
So I ended up finding a map online of this dungeon and realizing I was, like, at the very beginning of the dungeon again.
See, you can play Metroid 2. Who are you on about all those months ago?
He just doesn't want to.
Selective.
Exactly.
So, all right, that's Tales of Innocence. Now, Greg, you have a WiiWare game that I'm very curious to get some impressions on.
And yet it moves. Yes. So this is apparently I'm completely unaware of its existence as an indie PC game that came out last year.
I've played a demo, but it's as you can. I bet you can imagine it's kind of awkward on a keyboard and mouse.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I really don't play anything on my PC. So I've never been a fan of getting into that whole conundrum. So this, And Yet It Moves, is a better platformer based around the concept of rotating the world around the character. And on the PC version, I think this worked by going in discrete 90-degree increments, whereas on the Wii...
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
Whereas on the Wii version now, you've got the full range of rotation. And you can actually do this in a bunch of different ways. You can just play it with the Wii remote NES style and then sort of, you know, twist the controllers or like Excite Truck style to twist the world. Or you can have Wii remote and nunchuck and then sort of twist the remote Metroid Prime 3 style to twist the world. Or you can use the classic controller and the shoulder buttons to do it. So you've got a bunch of different options there. I was kind of happy with playing it with the NES style myself. It seemed pretty okay like that, as long as you kind of remember to reset yourself in a kind of relatively neutral position after each one. You didn't get yourself in a twist or anything. So Yeah, I mean, that part of it, bringing the full range of motion to it and the way it controls, it feels good. So, I mean, the key aspect of the gameplay here, you know, it's a platform game. You go through these crazy kind of winding and looping environments, you know, to take advantage of the fact that you can rotate everything. But the key is, as you fall, you accelerate, and at some point you're going to hit a speed whereby if you make contact with the ground, you will die. You sort of view this like little paper character that just, you know, rips into all these little bits. The key thing is, though, is that speed is maintained even after you turn. So say, for instance, if you was falling down next to some ground, and you achieve that speed and then twisted it, all right, you're only just a tiny few pixels away from that ground, but because you've achieved that velocity already, it will still kill you.
You're just going to smash into the ground.
Even though you're really close to it, you will still smash and you will die. So that's really what you're dealing with. The primary thing is you can never get too far away from the ground as you're kind of rotating the world around your character. Otherwise, you'll just fall too fast and die as soon as you hit anything. Although there is an achievement in the game for completing a level without touching the floor. So I think maybe if you can get it all the way to an exit,
nice.
Is possible to actually.
So it has, like, even though it's on WiiWare, it has, like, its own.
It has its own achievement system, yeah. Cool. We've got quite cool. A robust set of different things you could do. So, yeah, that's a nice touch for a start. So, but that's the primary thing you're doing. And in the early going, you're just kind of getting used to tackling these weird looping environments with those basics. And that's fun to start with. And then it moves on quite quickly to start getting more puzzle-based. For instance, this is kind of a spoiler, I guess, but I mean, it's pretty transparent how you do it, but it's still fun. For instance, you have a springboard that you need to use to get to a higher location. But when you just jump off it, you can't build up enough momentum, you know, to actually spring up high enough to get to where you need to go. So what you do is you spring up to the highest point of your jump, turn it 180 degrees, let yourself fall farther, then turn it back another 180 degrees, and then that will give you enough distance to build up enough speed so that when you spring back up, it's high enough that you get to where you need to go. That's the kind of thing that you get to. There's lots of clever ideas in it. There's definitely, in the closer stage of the game, there's a period where you have to control, well, you don't really control two characters, but there are two characters, one of which is like a shadow of you, and you need to take account of that at the same time while you're twisting everything around, just to increase the difficulty a bit. And I mean, as I've read in reviews, yeah, this is an idea that in itself could probably sustain a whole game. A whole downloadable game anyway. But here it's limited to just a few little instances. So, I mean, it is quite short. It's, you know, probably take you about 3 hours to play through the main chapters, but it doesn't dwell on any ideas for very long. It's got quite a few different ideas. It does them and it moves on.
So you're recommending it then?
I think it's really quite good. I'm not quite probably as warm on it as some of the reviews have suggested. I think, first of all, I'm really not a fan of the audiovisual presentation of the game. It doesn't endear itself to me. It's kind of all like
paper cutout.
Yeah, it's all
stuff.
Yeah, the paper cutout stuff. Yeah, there's some amusing things with that. This sort of like photograph of a hamster with sort of devil horns plastered on it that chases you at one point. You know, there's amusing little touches like that, but a lot of the time it isn't very endearing, especially the sound design though. The sound design kind of goes for this kind of minimalist sort of noise thing. It just didn't work for me. Put a podcast on.
Yeah.
And then so the rest of the visuals, I mean, it does change somewhat, but it didn't do much for me. But I mean, that's not a big deal. I mean, the only other thing I'd say is that there are parts in between the sort of clever bits, essentially, where you kind of feel like you're going through the motions in terms of like, okay, well, this is another, you know, twisty environment that I've got to kind of navigate my way through. And because it can be quite slow, because it's like, okay, jump and twist and then jump and twist, you know, and you're stopping, everything kind of stops every time you initiate a twist. Some of those little bits can kind of just, you know, be a little bit tedious at times, but not severely to the detriment of the game at all. Like I said, it keeps the new ideas coming. And apparently, I haven't really delved into this yet, I just finished the main chapters, but apparently it does have some what sounds to be very interesting additional modes. For instance, like, yeah, you've got a time attack, that kind of, you know, maybe you'd expect that, but there's also a limited rotations mode, where you've got to navigate your way through the whole level by only spinning the world around a fixed number of times, which I think is always going to turn it into a puzzle game, because then you've got to think about, well, what can I manage without twisting everything, and what can't I? You know, because you will, in the course of the normal game, you get quite adept at using the twist in little subtle increments to finesse your jump and all. Then to take that all away and say, well, now you've got to conserve them and use only when necessary, I think could be really interesting. So it's 1,000 points, you know, so it's not like super premium, but it is, you know, but some people might think it's expensive for the running time, but with those extra modes and all that, I think it should be good value if you like a good, you know, kind of puzzle platformer.
Well, I might just check it out soon. The last game of new business is one that I played in the past week. It's Prince of Persia: The Forgotten Sands, which is the one that came out about the time of the movie. It's not related to the movie, but I've heard that the Wii version is different somehow. I think the level designs are somewhat different. I don't think there's anything in the HD versions that really couldn't be done on the Wii. I think this was probably a different developer, and they just felt like kind of getting creative and doing their own thing with it. Anyway, I played it on 360, and it's interesting. I'm a pretty big fan of the Prince of Persia reboot, you know, the sort of cel-shaded one from a couple of years ago. And Forgotten Sands is definitely straight back to Sands of Time. I mean, it's almost a clone of Sands of Time, just in the style of it, the kinds of puzzles that they give you, just the feel of the action. And they're trying to sort of recreate all the story things that Sands of Time did so well. That game was almost revolutionary in the way that it told a story, the way that it had really meaningful, interesting, endearing dialogue between your main character and this AI character, Farah, who is always sort of just over on the side, you know, just on a parallel path. You can sort of talk while you're both killing dudes and you're running.
Or she's shooting you with an arrow.
Yeah.
And then apologizing.
Or she's shooting arrows into the wall to give you something to climb up on. There's just some really cool interaction. And ultimately, I think the story of Sands of Time is not super deep or anything, but it's just told in a really clever, very well done way. And Forgotten Sands doesn't pull that off, unfortunately. It sets out with introducing you to your brother Malik, who is the prince of, I don't remember the name of the country, but it's this region or this castle where the game takes place. And he's never been mentioned in any of the three original, you know, in the original trilogy from last generation that started with Sands of Time. So it just feels like they just invented this guy because they needed to make a new game. And he's not interesting. He doesn't seem to have any real rapport with the prince. And pretty soon he becomes the bad guy, which means he doesn't talk to you after about the halfway point in the game. And then you have this Jen character who's like, she lives in this mystical realm, and she grants you the power over time and the power over water, etc. And she's just so detached that she, you know, she's not really that interesting. You never really feel like there's any kind of romance or even a friendship really between her and the prince until the very end of the game, where she becomes a sword basically, and she becomes the sword that you have to use to beat the final boss. And then it's really weird because now she's actually with you while you play the game, and she's like commenting on your combat skills, and she's joking back and forth with the prince. And that is weird because that actually feels like all the previous Prince of Persia games that had this really great sort of, you know, back and forth character development and dialogue that was actually entertaining and nicely written and nicely performed. There was some really good stuff like that in the cel-shaded one from 2008. And it's completely lacking in this game until like the last 30 minutes. It's just really weird to see it go back to that at the very end. I wish it had been more like that all throughout, because I really like that element. Gameplay-wise, it's extremely similar to Sands of Time. In fact, a lot of the trap segments where you're just kind of running through corridors full of buzzsaws and, you know, spike logs that are swinging back and forth, you could have taken that out of any Prince of Persia game, and I wouldn't have been able to tell you which one it was from.
Why the hell are so many buzzsaws in Persia? I don't understand.
Yeah, I know. It's... Just one of those things.
There are no trees. It's not exactly a highly forested region of the world. I mean, holy crap. It's like they are historically known for importing wood.
Yes, that's a good point. The interesting thing about Forgotten Sands is actually what it does with water, which you probably heard about when the game was first released a few months ago. And I guess it kind of makes sense in that they're in this palace. It's kind of like Dune where, you know, having a lot of water in your home is like a symbol of royalty and wealth and status. So there are these giant chambers with just fountains and sprays of water coming out of the wall and waterfalls all along the walls. And so it's a nice excuse for them to put a lot of water in the environment, certainly much more than you've seen in other Prince of Persia games. And you get this ability fairly early in the game that lets you not exactly freeze water. It doesn't become ice, but it just sort of becomes solid for a few seconds. And you control how long it happens for. So basically, it's just a shoulder trigger. You hold that down, and now the water is solid, and you can run across it. You can grab onto a jet of it as a pole or a column, depending on the orientation. And you can jump off of off walls that used to be waterfalls, whatever. But as soon as you let go of the trigger, it goes back to liquid. And it seems like a fairly almost too simple of a mechanic. I mean, basically, you're just turning water into the things that you were already jumping around on anyway when they are made of stone. So I was pretty skeptical that this would actually be an interesting mechanic because it just seems very superficially different than what you do anyway. But what's interesting is how they use it to sequence different moves that you do. And the other powers, they're less noteworthy, but you get more powers later in the game. And they're used in a similar way in that they're all mapped to these shoulder buttons. And it gets to be very tricky in how you sequence it. And I'll give you an example. Let's say there are two horizontal jets of water that you can freeze. And when you do that, they become like poles that you can swing around, right? This is a very common thing in Prince of Persia. In between them is a waterfall. Okay. So if you're holding down the trigger to freeze and you're swinging on this pole, you jump off of it. If you keep the trigger held down, you'll just slam into that waterfall because it's not a solid wall, and you just fall down and die, and then you have to rewind time. So what you have to do is hold down the trigger to make the pole solid, swing off the pole while you're in midair, let go of the trigger to let the waterfall become liquid so you can pass through it, and then very quickly push the trigger again to make the second pole solid so that you can actually land on it. And these patterns just become more and more and more complex, and they're pretty interesting. It's not an amazing advancement in the series, I feel like, but it's a good excuse to make a new game. And at first, I wasn't sure if there was going to be enough of a good excuse. So in the end, I was pretty satisfied with it. I don't think it does enough new stuff, but if you really like the Prince of Persia games and you just want more of that, it's exactly what you're getting here. The combat, you can tell that they put some effort on it. It ends up feeling, it's interesting. So in 2008, the cel-shaded Prince of Persia had a really weird combat system where it was always one-on-one fights. And you were cooperating with this Elika, this magical person who was, you know, you could do certain moves with her. In this game, it's just you as the prince, and you're fighting hordes of guys. I mean, sometimes there will be like 30 to 40 enemies like just surrounding you. And so there's a lot of crowd control. You know, you're trying to figure out which moves will knock back the most number of enemies so I can get a chance to sort of run away or just to kind of divert my attention to in another direction. And it works pretty well, but it ends up feeling a lot like a slower version of Devil May Cry or Bayonetta or God of War. You know, so it just kind of feels like they just kind of made it like the combat in a lot of other games. So it doesn't really have that much uniqueness to it anymore. But it is functional. It's not the reason to play it, but the combat it's decently fun, I think.
High praise.
It's serviceable. Well, in some of the previous games, it hasn't been very good. So I think they've gotten it up to sort of par. But it's not really anything special in terms of combat. I mean, the reason to play the game is for these environmental platforming puzzles. And that stuff, they've kind of refreshed it just enough to warrant making a new game, but it's very, very familiar. And I was okay with that. I like that stuff. That's why I like the series. So anyway, that's Forgotten Sands. I've heard the Wii version's pretty good, so if you only have a Wii, you know, you should feel safe to go and check that out as well. And that's going to do it for new business.
Actually, hold on, Johnny. There is one piece of new business that I forgot.
There damn well better be.
At the top of the show. I have a game called Enjoy Your Massage that I experienced.
You experienced.
I would call it an erotic journey, if you will.
But you know what? You know, it's funny because when it was an Emmanuel game, that's exactly what it was.
So James took it upon himself to man up, I guess you could call it, and send me, unsolicited, mind you, a copy of Enjoy Your Massage. So over the last week or so, I tried to download it a couple times, and I was apparently having network problems, probably for the good of everybody involved. I wasn't able to download it, but tonight I was actually able to download it just before the podcast, so I played it for about a half an hour, which is about the entire breadth of content in the entire game.
The entire game, yes.
Not surprising. But
now, before we need to set the scene first.
James is like giddy right now.
Were the lights down low, and did you have candles on?
Check.
Okay, was the wife present and ready?
Present and accounted for.
There you go.
Is there a co-op mode? Can you play it with your wife? Or does she just have to watch?
Like, it's an alternative reality co-op mode.
Well, yeah. This is Enjoy Your Massage. It's an incredibly simple game. You are a masseur, and you have just been employed by a beauty farm, quote unquote.
Beauty farm.
Beauty
yes.
farm. And
I don't think those exist.
I don't know, but I'm sure they use a lot of hose at them. You know, strictly for cultivation purposes, but
wow.
Yeah, so it's extremely simple. It's effectively just like a Simon game, if anybody can remember way back to those Simon games where it would flash.
Way back to where they still make them.
Way back where you the game is effectively, they have some setup with a really kind of bad anime setup kind of thing where a woman, always a woman, comes in and says, you know, the head of the beauty farm says, okay, we have this customer coming in and she does such and such and take good care of her.
Now speak of their professions, because they're worth noting.
Yeah, their professions are like a race car driver, race or a motorcycle racer, and there is a blushing bride. This is her wedding day and everything's supposed to be perfect.
She's come to her
everything's massage. Supposed to be perfect, but she has a backache. And the other woman, I've done 3 of the 6 clients. I'm not too sure if any Jesus. Clients are unlocked, and you can bet your ass I'm going to play through the rest of the game to find that out. So the actual gameplay, it just shows the view of the woman laying on her stomach, and her back has a grid, has a 3x3 grid on it. And so it lights up a series of, you know, the squares in the grid in a certain order, and you have to match that order, and that's the whole game. And
that's the whole game.
And there's
just
a,
repeating patterns.
Yeah, and
monkey
every
see,
time
monkey
you
do.
You click on something, there's a little piano chime. So it gets progressively maddening the longer you play, because it's really weird. It's like, I think for a while there, I almost kind of fell asleep because, I mean, the only sound.
Because you were so relaxed.
Yeah, well, there's like this, we're so bored. It's like this crazy, there's like this Muzak playing in the background, and all you hear are these piano chimes. Ding.
Is it possible to massage them in such a way that it plays The Entertainer?
You could probably do it.
Syncopated massage.
You got 9 notes to do it with.
Is it like the 9 notes from a telephone, like a touchtone phone? Oh, I hope that's exactly what they are.
If you were on your wedding day and you've had a bit too strenuous of a hen night, if you know what I mean, mm-hmm. what you need is to go and get a massage from a guy who's going to play the Close Encounters thing on your back, and then you're sorted for the big day.
Yeah, I tried to do chopsticks, but I failed. I got fired. You actually get fired when you fail. So,
what?
Yep. You get fired. So
this sounds exactly like a real massage.
The funniest thing was my wife. She's watching me play it, and she's like, "This is excruciating."
You're a braver man than I am, John.
She couldn't handle it. She actually left the room. She was like, "I'm out of here. I cannot," because you have to understand the room is totally.
If you came in and you were watching Hostel Part Deux, then you know you should be fine with that. But enjoy your massage.
It's,
no way.
Yeah, it's too much to handle because it's boring enough to play, but to watch it is just it's horrendous because you're sitting there, the room is totally quiet. Do do do. That's the entire soundtrack. I mean, you could put the soundtrack, you could combine it into one MP3. That's amazing.
Maybe they did.
A MIDI file.
Oh, you didn't offer her a chance to play?
That's yeah, I did. Very nice. I did. She wasn't interested.
Oh.
All right. Thanks very much. Now we're going to enjoy our break. And when we come back, we're going to do a quick feature topic on hardware price drops. And then we've got a couple of emails from you listeners. So stick around.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
This week on NintendoWorldReport.com, Zach reviews Metroid Other M, the game you just heard us talk about. How does it hold up to past games in the franchise? Check out his review for the answer. We also have an interview with the developers at Beenox Studios, who are making Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions for the Wii and all the other platforms. Thomas Wilson is the creative director there, and we ask him the hard questions, like why motion controls are not used for swinging. Check out his interview to find out why this Spider-Man game should be on your radar.
We've got more Flip Twisted World Dev Journals. This time it's on Like a Boss Part 1, where Dave Campbell tells us about creating the first three bosses of the game. And in reviews from Neil, we have 3D Mahjong, which is 3D Mahjong. Congratulations. DSiWare, everybody!
Okay, on the review side, we have Wipeout, the game.
Oh, no!
For Nintendo DS, reviewed by Matt Blunden.
Oh, this is the racing thing on PS3.
No, hold on, Johnny. I think you have it mixed up with a game show that's, I think, on ABC.
Oh.
Hold on. It's even better. This minigame collection impresses Matt with its large amount of content, but can't stand up to repeated playthroughs. Read his review to find out. And in the blog area, we have James Jones giving us The Lord Giveth and UPS Taketh Away. He spins a harrowing tale of boxes, possibly box hunting, Ugg boots, and lost love. All right, maybe not lost love, but you got to check out the end of his Xbox 360 return adventure.
It better damn well be the end.
We have an interview about Deca Sports with Makoto Kawaguchi, the producer of Deca Sports, who tells us about the series' success, how they like all of the different motion control options out there nowadays, and what they might be doing for 3DS. And finally, we have a blog by Carly about pants versus pants, a cultural divide. It gives us a cultural schooling about the meaning of the word pants. Yes, pants. Take a trip deep inside the English psyche in her wildly entertaining blog.
Just for the sake of reference, it's about the Kirby clip from the opening of the game.
It feels like pants.
Yes.
To which yeah. will be changed to, it feels like trousers.
Which doesn't sound nearly as nice.
Alright, we are back, and before we get into the listener mail, we're going to do a quick little feature here about hardware pricing. This is apropos of the recently announced DSi price drop. The DSi and the DSi XL are going to be, in September, are going to be reduced by $20 each, whereas the DS Lite, which is still in production and still on the market, is remaining at $129 in North America. So anyway, two of the three current DS models are getting a $20 price drop. It's not a huge change, from $189 to $169. That was kind of what made me think about this topic and might make it interesting to address. It's like, what is the segment of the population that is now going to consider buying a DSi or an XL when they wouldn't have before? I mean, is $20 that much of a difference? Well, John and James both already have DSIs, but mm-hmm. for Greg and I, is that going to change our minds and make us kind of jump on the bandwagon for this thing?
I think principally the most impact it would have is on impulse purchasing or near impulse purchasing. People who would buy these things, you know, relatively on a whim. If you can tip them over the edge by saying, oh, well, it's cheaper now than it was 3 weeks ago, so you're getting a good deal, right? That might just be the little impetus it needs to push an impulse buy over the edge. For people like you and I, it's not going to be, you know, enough of a difference to the calculus, really.
Yeah, calculus is a good word because, I mean, I don't sit down and write a budget when I'm thinking about buying a video game system, but I do my research, and I think about it a lot, and I think about how many games are there that I want to play that I can't play without that system, and how much are those going to cost me, and can I wait? You know, what does it cost me in terms of gaming if I wait? That's the kind of thing I think about. But a lot of people are speculating that this price drop is probably to clear out inventory before the 3DS launch. I think it's a little early for that, unless they're dropping the 3DS in November, which they're not, not in America at least, or Europe. I think it's a little early to be clearing out inventory, and so I wonder if maybe they're trying to preempt some kind of PSP price drop that they think might be threatening. Because there's a lot of talk of Sony putting out a new PSP 2 or something like that, mm-hmm. and that could be accompanied by a pretty steep decline in PSP prices.
Why would they be scared of a PSP price drop? What do they have to fear?
Because, James, now, as you've seen, the sales of DS are kind of falling off. That it's affected Nintendo's bottom line quite a bit. And once you get down below a certain level, it's not so much selling on its name or on principle anymore. It's kind of more down in the trenches, you know, with the other also-rans or whatever. So I think maybe now, because they've exhausted a lot of the market for this thing, a lot of the people who are left would consider a PSP because they don't really have a strong allegiance either way.
Again, you're talking about that impulse purchase kind of territory,
right,
aren't you? And side by side, you know.
Maybe it's the iPhone and not the PSP.
If you can get a PSP or an iPod Touch for $99, then a $150 DS doesn't make a whole lot of sense. If you don't even know the difference between the three, among the three, then you're going to go for the cheapest one. So, I mean, I'm just wondering if they might be trying to kind of realign it with some of the competition now that they've sold to the majority of the people who were planning to buy one. What do you think, James?
I still don't think the PSP has any bearing whatsoever in any decision Nintendo makes anymore. I think they regard that as a vanquished foe.
What about the iPod Touch, which Apple this week claimed that they have sold more iPod Touches than, I quote, Nintendo plus Sony combined, which I assume means DS and PSP combined.
That statistic would be wrong.
I'm kind of dubious as to the accuracy of that.
Apple is absolutely notorious for bullshit statistics that are completely false. And it's physically impossible they've sold more iPod Touches than just DSs.
That would mean that they've sold close to 150 million iPod Touches. And I'm trying to think. I think I've met one person ever who owns an iPod Touch.
Yeah, that
there's no way they've sold more of those than iPhones.
And they've not sold 150 million iPhones. So,
right.
So yeah, they're full of shit. But that's normal for them. They're always full of shit.
Let's talk a little more generally about price drops. Not necessarily the DSi one that was just announced. That's just kind of the entry point. But have you found that historically in your personal gaming habits, have hardware price drops been a big factor for you? Have you ever bought a system because they dropped the price on it?
PS3. We both did that, didn't we, Johnny?
I did too.
For me, it's new hardware. More so than price.
So you're not so price sensitive, but you want like the latest version of it.
Yeah, I mean, I bought a PS3 when it was $600. Price, not really.
The few, the proud.
Not really a problem.
So when this topic came up, I said John's strategy on buying systems is who he can give the most money to at any given moment.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's like an auction.
So John, I assume you didn't get a PS3 Slim because you didn't perceive it as really an upgrade.
No.
He's got six of them.
Well,
right,
no, I mean, I never did. I never even, I mean, I've had my launch 60 gig PS3. I mean, it has everything in it. That's why it was $600.
Backwards compatibility.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it has a PS2 inside of it.
It's the Cadillac of gaming consoles.
Yep.
I'm with you a little bit, John. I do like to have the newest thing, but I'm a little more hesitant on price. The $600 was never going to fly for me. But I did recently buy a slim Xbox 360, the new version of that. And it's weird because I've only had my Xbox for 2 years, so it's not like it was failing. Yeah. I wasn't really concerned about it failing. But for me, it was the fact that I wanted better wireless and built-in wireless because I had this third-party thingamajig that wasn't very dependable. I had problems with it from time to time. So I wasn't crazy about that thing. And, you know, buying an official one is $100. So that was part of it. I wanted a bigger hard drive because I was starting to really frequently have to delete things because I was running up to the limit. And again, upgrading the hard drive to my existing 360 would have been quite expensive. So those two things combined, plus the fact that I knew I could sell my old one for like $100. So the net cost to me would be less than the actual cost of the system. It's still splurgy, but I kind of justified it to myself and that there are practical reasons for doing it. These are things that I wanted to upgrade anyway, so it's fairly reasonable to do so.
Quiet.
But that, of course, that's not even a price drop there.
Yeah, that's just, you know, sort of shuffling the pack, which is, you know, obviously Nintendo's very fond of that with handhelds.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised that the Wii, when Nintendo dropped the price from $250 to $200, I was really surprised at the apparent influence of that price drop on sales, because the sales did go up a lot.
Yeah, there was a really strong holiday, wasn't it, off the back of that record
stuff.
And
there's an argument to be made that they might have gone up a lot anyway.
Yeah, it's holiday, it's New Super Mario Brothers. I mean, there were other factors.
It's hard to confirm that was what caused it. I'm sure it helped some, but how much is the question. But I was just thinking that, you know, the difference between, the psychological difference between like $300 and $250 or $300 and $200 is a lot bigger than $250 to $200. To me, it just psychologically didn't seem like a very big change to go from $250 to $200. But then, not even 6 months after that, they added Wii Sports Resort and the Motion Plus to it for the same price, which is kind of like another price drop.
It's like another $50 off, basically.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I think the Wii is a really good value because you get two games and all these controllers with it for $200. That's a pretty good deal. I mean, that might be enough for some people. Some people might not ever buy any other games because you already get Wii Sports and Resort, which are two of the best games on the system.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems like a good deal, and I don't see Nintendo dropping the price on the Wii this holiday season because it's already seems like it's kind of on target.
I think the question as well is, you know, why do firms do price cuts, right? It's to boost revenue, ultimately. You know, they think that they're going to increase sales in such a way that, you know, despite the fact they're making less on each unit, overall revenue is going to increase. Well, right. For Nintendo, who've already got a lot of product out there, at this point, maybe if you go from 200 to 150, for instance, you'd get a bump. As I said, you get these impulse purchases for people. It's like, oh, I'm getting a good deal. I'm lucky.
But
is the
bump enough to?
But that bump has to be big enough to actually then say, well, actually, you know, a bunch of people were going to buy them at X date anyway. And they could have bought them at $200. So have you actually, by increasing sales, actually increased revenue? And at this point with the Wii, down from where they are now, I'm kind of skeptical that it would increase revenue.
Let me espouse a more complex theory that comes into play, at least in certain systems.
You complex? Never.
Yeah, well, thank you. In the case of Sony, if you'll remember, when the PS3 cost some stupid amount of money because their market planning was shit terrible. There were publishers basically saying they had to drop the price of the system because its sales were abysmal and it was affecting them. So it's more than just increasing revenue. I think in some cases it's you're willing to take the hit for market share purposes.
Yeah, but that was where I put the caveat of Nintendo with the amount of product they've already got out there. I mean,
Nintendo's market share is like 60%.
Hold on,
there's
an extension to that point that still affects Nintendo, which is the active market share. How many Wii owners right now are currently buying games? Somebody who's just bought a Wii is more likely to go out and buy new games along with it than somebody who's had a Wii for 2 years but only uses it to play Wii Sports.
But also the people that are buying Wiis at this point, although they're going to be, as you said, in their life cycle as a Wii owner more active at the beginning, in general, they're probably not going to be the most avid purchasers because, you know, these are the people who are coming to it. It's obviously worth the least to them because they're only getting in now when the price is lowest.
I wonder if I could introduce another topical topic into this, which is that if you're the kind of person who's not going to buy a Wii until it's down to like $150 or even $100 for the system, maybe you're also the kind of person who's just going to buy a bunch of used games to fill up your library.
Yeah, and how much is that going to
last? That's not appealing to Nintendo or anyone else.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends. What's the market of the person who's now buying a Wii? If you're not, if you're just someone who impulse buys a Wii, odds are you probably don't go to stores that sell used games that much.
Not to get sidetracked, James, but the number of stores that are selling used games has just increased a lot.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a lot easier to find that stuff in the back half of this generation. So that could be an issue.
See, I think for Nintendo right now, they would literally say, all right, we're going to cut the price on the system in the hopes of just impulse buying it during holidays, and people will buy games to go with it.
But I think the question is that they would still achieve a certain level of impulse holiday buys at $200.
Right. But
so it's a simple question of, does it generate enough more to actually increase revenue overall? And I just think when we're down at this level, I'm skeptical. I think there's better ways to increase revenue that they could do. Probably, some sort of shuffling of the pack with bundles.
Or just running new ads.
Yeah, remarketing, new software.
Donkey Kong Country will sell Wiis, I bet you.
Some.
It's a big name. It's a big enough name to do so.
Kirby won't. I mean, the average person doesn't know what Kirby is.
No
one knows. Care. But Donkey Kong Country, I don't think it's going to be as big as a typical Nintendo holiday release.
No, no.
That is their big, November game.
So here's why, but we're talking about, well, we're not talking about it specifically, but this came up because of the DS. And I think that a good reason why they would do this is to complement the big, massive wave of DS titles they actually have coming out at the end of the year. There's a lot of product coming out in the next 4 months for the DS.
Yeah, we've got Golden Sun, Laytona, as I like to call it.
There's third-party apps or third-party games coming out for it.
What are the big third-party games on
this?
Well,
the biggest right now is
the new Final Fantasy.
And there's Ghost Trick.
Super Scribblenauts. So the first one did pretty well.
It did do pretty well.
I hate to break it to you, James. Ghost Trick is going to be a blip on the radar.
Well, it's still... it's
you and I will like it a lot, but...
to people who are picking up a DS now.
I mean, look,
the DS is far from dead, especially in America. But one thing I thought was interesting was this. The price cuts already happened in Japan and the UK. Yeah, June, I think it was. Yeah. The way they went was that, specifically in Japan, the light was pretty much like, sell it for whatever you feel you can. Japanese retailers. Whereas the Lite is now relatively higher priced than it was before in America because the DSIs have come towards it. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what that says about the fact that they, in some ways, feel like the DSIs aren't performing that great because the Lite looks like so much of a better value proposition to some people in America, and therefore they're just kind of trying to make the DSI more competitive.
So they're now competing between their own. Products.
Honestly, they should probably just cut off the light and be like, "All right, it's done."
I think it's just doing too well for them at the minute, though.
But I mean, if you cut out the light and drop the eye into its price point, I mean, is the eye really that much more expensive?
Well, I think
than
they still like what the DSi and the XL give them in terms of these different premium SKUs and price discrimination of a sort. Getting different kinds of customers and stuff. But they probably feel like what we see with the MPDs and stuff is the aggregate figures. We don't really see what's happening between the SKUs.
Nintendo does.
Nintendo does. Yeah. And what they're probably looking at is saying, look, we like this model of the different SKUs, but looking at the figures right now, it's out of whack for people. If we bring the DSi and the XL closer to the Lite, we can sort of do a similar sort of thing, but increase volume overall because they are going to look like more competitive deals.
Yeah, could be.
I mean, as it stands, the Eye is not an appreciably better system than the Lite.
But you see, in Japan, the DS Lite is much more of just a non-issue.
Yeah. Well, because everybody in Japan owns one, right?
So, James, the question is now, with the new prices, is the DSi $20 better than the DS Lite? I would say, yeah, sure. If I didn't already have a DS, I would probably go for the DSi because it's only $20 more. The problem is it still doesn't help me to upgrade because I've already got a DS that works fine.
I think if you didn't have a Lite before, or if you didn't have any DS before, you went with the Eye anyway because it's a better product in general. But I'm thinking more in terms of Nintendo's cost. Is it really beneficial to them in the grand scheme of their corporate strategy to maintain these three price points right now? Or would it be easier and more affordable for them to say, all right, we're just going to kill the light and drop the eye into its price point.
Maybe they are killing the light.
Well, even in Japan, though, where the light is not huge or anything, you know, certainly not as successful as in America, it still ticks over a bit. You know, I mean, they haven't literally murdered it there, even, where they're kind of living in the future compared to, you know, the other markets, because it's all happened a bit earlier.
All right, well, let's end it there. Interesting little discussion. Of course, let us know what you think about the DSi price drops. Is it going to sell you one? Do you care? Are you pissed because you just bought one and you paid the higher price? I don't know. What does this mean for 3DS? It's interesting stuff, so let us know what you think. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and you can write in, just like Jim, who says, while I own a Wii and a 360 and would also have a PS3 if I could afford it and didn't dislike the controller so much, I've always been a Nintendo first gamer. I see Kinect and Move coming out and find the technology very intriguing and would like to try them out for myself to see what they have to offer. However, in the back of my mind, I'm kind of hoping that these extensions of their respective platforms bomb when released. This isn't because I'm some ridiculous hardcore gamer and worried about the casuals or some garbage like that, but I just want the Wii to remain the unique platform. Also, third parties have pumped almost nothing but bullplop, that's what he wrote, onto the Wii and then whine that there isn't a market there when the plop doesn't sell. And I don't want to see them make games for these new hardware options, Kinect and Move, that could have been put on the Wii in one shape or another years ago. Am I evil for part of me wanting these new options to fail and to taste the tears? Taste the tears, Scott Tinnaman.
WWE?
Of the gaming press and Nintendo haters.
I don't see any chairs being flung.
I can hear one.
Do you think Kinect and Move will catch fire with the mainstream
in a
mainstream manner? Why can't I just be a happy Omni gamer that is glad for lots of options? I love the internal psychological drama of this question. Like, yeah. Am I a bad person for wanting Nintendo to win and for these other things to die in a fire?
Well, I think
he needs to write into Fraser Crane rather than RFN.
Yeah, probably.
I think to answer the question, I think, well, first off, it's a very good thing that you don't live in, like, well, I don't know. Maybe Jim lives in Ireland, because if he does, his Kinect ain't gonna work all the way.
Because it won't understand his voice.
That's it's region locked. So the voice enabling isn't gonna work in all
regions.
Yeah,
it's not gonna be good for a little while later in Europe, right? That's what I've heard.
Yeah, I've read the funny story that the only Spanish option that it will understand is Mexican Spanish, and so when they sell it in Spain, people, it's going to have a hard time understanding Spanish people.
And Spain's one of the regions it's going to start turned on in. Yeah. What the hell? There you go.
But you have to speak with a Mexican accent.
Look, there's your answer. We've already
in Spain. That's hilarious.
In terms of generally, you know, I think this goes to what kind of a Nintendo fan or what kind of fan of Nintendo you are. I mean, for me, there's a very, very big difference between me being a Nintendo fan and me being a Bills fan. Now, let me encapsulate that like this. If Nintendo had kicked me in the nuts for 20 years straight, like the Bills have, I wouldn't have bought any of their products for a very long time. My relationship with Nintendo is thoroughly conditional on them releasing good products, and I'm quite perfectly willing to buy the products of others.
Are you saying you're a fair-weather fan of Nintendo?
Relatively speaking, yeah. I mean, you know, it's about, you know, as much great affection as I've got for the old games and what they, you know, did for me in my childhood and all that kind of stuff. At the end of the day, if it's not fun, if it's not giving me a great experience for my money, I wouldn't be still buying them. And
I agree with you. I think the definition of a fanboy is someone who will convince themselves that something is good or that they like something purely out of principle, like regardless of the actual quality of the thing. And that's how you are with the Bills. You love the Bills.
Well, I'm not in any...
I'm not saying you're delusional, but you love the Bills no matter how shitty they are.
It's just unconditional love.
Greg doesn't drink enough purple drink to think Trent Edwards is going to play well this year.
He'll spend plenty of time on his back this year, that's for sure.
But no, that's a great point, Greg.
I think we've already kind of given a pretty good answer regarding the issues with Kinect. I mean, we just described the fact that it's one of the primary features doesn't work.
I think Kinect and Move are hilarious. And I think you agree, James, right? I mean,
Kinect at least has an idea that's its own. Move
yeah,
is,
but they're
Move
both
is a complete...
they're grasping for straws.
Move is a clusterfuck. I mean,
no,
that's,
it's
that's
not.
The
it's a safe move is what you they
no,
should call
no,
it.
No, it's not though.
Who the hell is going to pay $150 for Kinect?
But Move is so complicated. There's so many
and
pieces
it adds
to
up.
It.
How? It's just a Wii ripoff. It's as simple as you can get.
Move bleeds you dry.
But everything's
like...
sold separately, John. That's the difference.
Yeah, but...
Wii includes the game and the controller and the nunchuck.
And the
everything
camera.
Everything you need to play.
But I'm just saying, like, all the Wii controllers rip you off, too. So what's the difference?
Yeah, I know, but sure. But at least you got the nunchuck and the remote with the system. I mean, you didn't have to go pay
right.
another... What, 100...
I think they're going to have a Move bundle.
They are, but
are.
It's going to cost them more. It's going to cost considerably more than the existing SKUs.
But you get a bigger hard drive and whatever.
To me, the motion stuff is just a weird fit for these systems because, I mean, the Wii was designed for motion control in mind. It is inherent to the system. That is how it was sold to you and me and everyone else. That may not be the reason that I got into it, but it was right up front. And it's a weird retrofit to try to put Kinect and Move onto these HD consoles that have existed as very different entities for the past 4 or 5 years.
Well, I think we all, well, you and I, Johnny, and the rest of the E3 crew watched the Microsoft press briefing.
Sure, and I loved it.
When they were showing Kinect, and the whole time you're like, okay, what are you doing with this? It's like, okay, I can control my ESPN 3, which, by the way, ESPN 3, I don't believe, is still on the Xbox.
It's not yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
What the hell?
I think I might be able to watch college football at home for the first time
in 3 years.
It would
be nice if they would have had it up at the start of the season, but they...
It would have been, yes. But they can't add these new features until the price increase is in effect.
Anyway. So I think the issue we have is that, like, with the Kinect, we didn't see anything. So we got the show floor of E3, and we had the dance game, which may have just been, like, randomly giving points. We don't know, because nobody played it, only professional dancers. And then we had things like Sonic Free Riders, which looked like people will die playing that game.
I think, but here's the thing, though. But, I mean, back to the question, I mean, look, if you are so confident that this is all derivative catch-up balls and is going to fail, then, can you not just be intensely relaxed at the inexorable prospect of it failing rather than rooting for it to fail?
I think I root
against the Patriots because they're probably going to fucking win.
Greg's still really upset about the Tom Brady Farm GQ shoot.
So anyway, I mean, the question isn't really about Move and Kinect. It's more about perception. It's more about wishing failure upon your enemies. Or are these our enemies? I mean, for me, I own all three, so
yeah.
I don't want them to fail, but I also don't want them to succeed. I'm sort of chuckling at this shit from afar because I ain't gonna buy it.
Here's the difference, though.
It's entertainment for me.
There are reasons to want something to not succeed, not just because of general hatred for the company in question. There are people who didn't want the Wii to succeed, not because they don't like Nintendo.
Because they thought it would be the end of all gaming?
Well, they just don't like the direction that it took gaming. They were very much conservative in their approach on what they wanted gaming to be. They wanted hardware iterations to be quadruple the power, and they wanted controls to remain very stagnant.
I mean, that kind of makes more sense to me when gaming was a smaller market. You know, now gaming is such a big market that there are going to be developers or publishers on platforms that will cater to pretty much every taste.
We call them Emmanuel.
The interesting thing now is that fans and fanboys of Microsoft and Sony are now going through the same inner turmoil and soul searching that we spent a lot of time discussing on this show a couple of years ago, which is the whole thing about... It's okay. I mean, you can always make the argument, well, if you don't like the motion control games, just don't buy them. You've still got your Marios and your Zeldas and your Metroids. But of course, you know, as we discussed quite a bit, these things do take resources away from the development of the games that you actually want. And so it is reasonable to have some kind of antagonism towards the motion control stuff if that's not what you're into. And there is now a very legitimate and widespread fear, I think, among people who play the other systems, that the perceived shittiness of the game library on Wii that has grown out of the motion control thing, fad, as it were. It seems to be a fad. Even Nintendo treats it like a fad now.
Yeah, yeah. We're playing all our games with the Wii Remote D-pad, yeah.
Hold the NES style. Oh, yeah. That's why I bought this system.
By the way,
can we
get like a Wii Remote Pro or something so we could have a better D-pad?
Amen,
maybe
brother.
Maybe you should invest in one of those third-party ones that light up.
I agree completely.
My personal favorite Wii Remote right now is clear plastic and it lights up.
that thing's ugly.
But actually, Johnny, I would like to react to that particular statement.
Sure.
Based on what we talked about, I'm sure it was last week or the week before, when we discussed the fact that the PS3's game library that has shown move really is just stuff that we saw on the Wii.
Yeah, it's been done. Yeah. And you know what's really shocking is that there was an early review of Tiger Woods with move over here in the official PlayStation magazine for the UK, and they shit on it.
In the official magazine, really?
Yeah, 4 out of 10. I mean, that when you think about how lauded the Wii Motion Plus version is, I am very shocked
by
that.
Well, I mean, here's what the issue with building a motion controls platform is. You have to have somebody with creative ideas. And that's not to say that these companies don't have creative people in them. It's that they don't have experience building ideas. They don't have things they can build on. They don't have their WarioWare smooth moves they can extrapolate into other games. All they've got is stuff that they've basically seen done on the Wii and tech demos they've done internally.
It seems that they're kind of reverse engineering a lot of the game designs.
Well, they are. I mean,
which that's a, let me tell you something. I know something about reverse engineering and it's not easy.
Look at Kinect Sports. I mean, holy crap.
Yeah.
I mean, right now, Rare is literally Microsoft's in-house reverse engineer Nintendo.
Rare is Microsoft's, you know, slave.
They did Avatars, they're doing Kinect Sports. I mean, they literally are the, just do whatever Nintendo's doing.
I mean, in terms of what Sony and Microsoft are running into now, I mean, yes, you could look at it as a response to Wii, and yeah, obviously to a great extent it is, especially when you look at Move. But it's also a response to the fact that developers don't really want to bump up the costs of making software with another generational leap. And all. I mean, there's fundamentals in terms of game development about where we are with hardware and costs and all this sort of stuff that are also driving this, and Nintendo were ahead of the curve because they saw this coming and decided to sort of, you know, get out of the arms race one step before the other guys.
So they get out on the really on the cheap, basically.
Yeah, so the point is that to what extent is Nintendo driving it, and to what extent is it just that Nintendo got out in front of what are fundamental forces at work in the gaming industry? You know, the people wanting Nintendo to fail for one thing, or Nintendo fans wanting other people to fail on the other hand, maybe gives these individual sort of actors in the gaming industry more credit than they deserve, because really what's going on is driven by the fundamental forces at work in the market.
I think the really interesting thing is that Kinect and Move cannot drive down. They can only drive up development costs.
Well, kind of.
Here's the thing. On those systems, you can't go down to Wii development costs on Xbox 360 and PS3. They're already at a higher level. You can't even hope to maintain them because there's a certain cost associated with learning to and implementing motion controls. On top of, you still have to make your games in 720p, and they still have to have online features and all that
stuff. It's definitely not lowering the cost of stuff like Killzone and SOCOM.
No, but
it's only additive.
It definitely is lowering the cost of stuff that Microsoft's making for Kinect. I mean, look at it. It's in 720p, but there's no texturing almost
but
at all.
But let me tell you something, James. I guarantee that Tiger Woods game for PS3 that uses Move costs them more to make than Tiger Woods did last year for PS3.
Well, yeah, no question, but still.
The point is, look, these companies are in the business selling hardware, not quite in the same way as Nintendo, as we know. But at this point, they've got manufacturing costs down to such a place where it's actually good for them to sell units. And then it's a question of, well, how do we sell units and going to try and reach out to more people? And that's a relatively cost-effective way of doing it. So, well, it's not better in the sense of it's more technically advanced, but it is different because the interface is different. And obviously, Nintendo already did it, and they're trying to do it the same way, just to move the numbers on the hardware. So it's the most cost-effective software approach to selling more hardware. But yeah, it's not as if it's negligible in terms of its effects on development costs either.
No. I wish I could see a year into the future just for this particular thing, because either Kinect and or Move, there will either be something that has been shown that actually proves these concepts and makes them seem viable, or they will be on the way out. They will be dead. I mean, well, it will happen that fast. They've got about
the
a
thing
one
is though
year
Move
window,
is Move is really low risk in the sense that all they have to do is just patch it into games, right? I mean, obviously it's not going to be as good as a game that's designed from the ground up. But if you look at Kinect, games have to be specifically made for Kinect. It's a lot more costly to make games for Kinect because you have to bind yourself to that hardware. With Move, mm-hmm. you can make a game that uses the DualShock 3 controller. You know, you can release it like that, and you don't even have to...
Heavy Rain is getting patched for Move.
Patch it in. So that's what I mean. It's very low risk for Sony, really.
I get that, but only Sony is going to go back and patch in their games, because there's no incentive for other developers
well,
to
Resident
do it.
Well, Resident Evil's doing it.
Yeah, but there's got to be some money changing.
Yeah, I'm
there.
Sure there's
They're
some
not
going to
sell
like...
a bunch of new copies of Resident Evil 5 from doing that. And Capcom doesn't make money when Move sells, so why are they doing it? Sony must be paying them to do it.
It's just a marketing checkbox for Sony, and you know what? That's fine. I'm okay with that. I really am, because, I mean, who cares? I mean, in the end...
Well, who cares? Jim cares. Jim cares. That's I mean, who cares. I mean, there are people who care. It's... I don't know. It's an interesting thing. We got a little off tangent there, but that's okay.
All I say is I do not agree with Jim, but I can understand his perspective if you substitute Kinect and Move for the Patriots and Cowboys.
Okay. So the next letter, I think Greg is the best person to read it. You'll understand why in a second.
Okay. So this is Steve from Kenosha, Wisconsin, and he writes, "Greetings, Magnanimous Podcast. Thank you once again for the most outrageously benign podcast on the internet. I greatly enjoyed your Mother 3 retroactive. It prompted me to seek out the fan translation for my pleasure. I was belayed, however, when I ran across Earthbound. Though I had started it several times, I'd never completed it and decided now was the time. Mother 2 still holds up extremely well, which puzzled me because it seems that many of my old favourites seem better left to my memories. Aside from the wonderful writing, I could only point to the battle system's lack of animation. Because all of the attacks are left to the imagination, I have no easy means of comparison to modern RPG battles, such as Dragon Quest IX. Sure, spells are still animated, but they seem abstract enough to get away with it. So, my question is, do you think Earthbound will hold up in the future because of the lack of animation? And similarly, are there any games from the modern generation which will hold up in the future when graphics and animation no doubt will be far more advanced?"
So this is a neat little topic, how game graphics hold up over time. Is it painful to go back and play your cherished childhood games because now they look bad?
So John, what did 2-bit games look like when they came out?
Well, they were on they're on the walls of caves, James.
Did you have to repaint each frame?
It was tough back then because usually
they didn't
have
paper,
wear...
so you drew the sketches across a long stretch of cave and then you ran really fast.
Yeah,
looked at it.
It was tough to play. The bear skins were heavy that you had to wear. So, but yeah, I mean, with this, it really depends. I think it really comes down to the art style of the game, to be honest with you, and really what the game's trying to accomplish. I mean, I think that there's a lot of arcade games from the 80s that still stand up really well. Ones that look older, I would say, would be ones that kind of rely on anything.
Mad Dog McCree.
Well, I think anything
FMV stuff is
really anything that was trying. Yeah, anything like FMV or anything that was trying to
push the envelope.
Yeah, push the envelope. Like anything with 3D. Like I think like Space Harrier now. Like, you know, I have a fondness for that game. Anybody else that looks at it would say that absolutely looks comical.
It looks like a piece of paper in front of another piece of paper moving around.
Yeah.
That is what that super
It's really what it is, but I mean,
that's
what it looks like, too. It looks like a
gimmicky stuff
book.
Just doesn't...
But even stuff like Doom though, like Doom looks terrible now. I can barely play
Doom
that game.
Doom is hideous. I mean, it's terrible.
Awful.
Yeah, but Doom was the first game that looked like that.
Yeah.
Well,
they were really pushing the envelope with Doom.
Oh, yeah, they were.
Absolutely. Carmack was, he was like the greatest graphics engine programmer
in
the world.
And a lot of people say the PSX Saturn N64 era is the toughest to go back to, you know, much more so than the NES or the Super NES, Mega Drive, etc. Because, you know, it was just branching out into 3D, but, you know, the geometry was really kind of crude and the textures were really bad, the frame rates and, you know, everything about it was just so kind of primitive that even though at the time we were all kind of bowled over by these things because it was just games in 3D, it's far more difficult to go back to than something just, you know, that has the kind of elegance of things like Super Mario Brothers or Mega Man.
Yeah,
right.
What's worse, inconceivably worse, is the 3D stuff that was on the Sega CD.
That's another story.
That stuff is so bad.
I don't think anyone thought that was good at the time.
No, that's so,
like, that's like sub Super FX chip.
It's so right. bad that your eyes will turn inside out to not see them anymore.
I mean, I think the original Star Fox is hard to look at now. I know a lot of people still like it a lot.
It's hard to tell what's going on, to be honest.
Yeah,
I mean,
I find it to be like almost like hallucinatory. Like it just it's so abstract.
It's like it's some res shit going on in that
game.
It's,
they have so little to work with that you certain shapes are meant to represent things, and I could grasp that when I was 14, but now I look at it and it just looks like a bunch of random shapes flying at me.
It's because that's what it is.
And they just have to, like, because it's all like flat shaded and stuff, the only way I can really distinguish it is like by having little flashing bits.
Yeah.
That's like kind of the main way in which they depict like engines or.
Well, like when you land on Venom and you have the little walker things. Those look horrible. They're so. They look like diamonds walking on top of other diamonds. It's it's really bad.
It's like Battlezone, just a little bit better.
No, it's Battlezone with the frames filled in. That's all it is.
See, I think vector stuff actually holds up really well.
Yeah, we have video proof of you consolidating that point.
I still think the vector stuff looks really cool.
Yeah.
Like, it can't age, because there's nothing now that looks like that.
Well, it can't age because at the time, I mean, it is what it was. It's lines, and this is what you got.
Yep. Yeah. We haven't found a better way to draw lines on a screen.
Well, at the time, they just looked cool, and they looked like what was in the arcades.
I think, what's a good example of a game that looks really crappy? I think even going back to like Mario 64 right now is really hard.
Yeah. Well, the issue with 64 games, if you play them in their original form as well, it's just the low resolution. It's really painful.
Everything's muddy. Everything is
it's
so
a big
muddy.
Thing that the Virtual Console does clear up. I mean, it doesn't address the low resolution nature of the textures, but
it just upscans everything.
Everything does look sharper thanks
but
to
But I mean just playing it on a regular TV, everything looks muddy. I mean, it just does.
Yeah, I mean, there was various issues with the N64 that made, you know, they sort of had really poor textures, but then like anti-aliased and stuff, so it just kind of smeared everything. And then it was low res within that, so everything kind of blends together.
I think the tough thing for especially a game like Mario 64 for me is not the graphics necessarily, but the camera. Just at the time, I was a lot more willing to put up with it because of the gee whiz,
the
you
novelty.
Know, of playing it in 3D. But when I go back to it now, that camera, it's really, we've come a long way.
The Lockiku is not helping yet very much. I think he went out drinking before he picked up his camera.
So, I mean, one of the points of the question is what games, you know, in the modern generation will hold up in the future? And one of the most obvious candidates is, you know, the stuff that's just 2D now that's really gorgeous in Kirby. I mean, I don't think that's going to age in the future.
No, I mean, upscaling, it might get kind of blurry. But I just said
that in the future, you know, will have lost none of its sort of striking nature because it's not about how incredibly detailed or anything. And you know, I mean, the animation is very fluid as it is.
And Kirby is intentionally fuzzy in that game, which actually makes it look better. So it'll be interesting to see how that changes on newer TVs.
So this isn't going to look great forever, but if you upscale it, and I've seen it upscaled, it looks amazing. I think Wind Waker still looks really amazing.
Yeah.
Well, Wind Waker probably already has and certainly will in the future have aged better than Twilight Princess.
Well, I always think it looks better than Twilight Princess.
Well, it does, but I mean, it's even with age, I think the disparity will be more.
Like, I've seen Wind Waker upscaled, so like if the Wii did upscaling to HD, which it doesn't really, I've seen what it would look like. It looks amazing.
Well, the beautiful thing about it, I think, if when you upscale things like that, and just, you know, like I said, obviously it's not going to put any more detail in it, but then, you know, Wind Waker isn't about detail.
No,
but what
exactly.
It is about is color. And I think when you upscale it, it's just a bit more sharp like that. The color tends to come through more.
I talked about that when I discussed how jarring it was to see HD color when I played Tales of Vesperia on the 360. Like, that's a game that'll age well.
No, I mean, that's one of the things we was talking about Mirror's Edge that, yeah, I think it would have lost on Wii, is that, you know, red on white, your stark contrast, so crisp in HD.
Oh, yeah.
Is a big part of that game's aesthetic.
To go to the game that was actually referenced, Earthbound, the lack of animation during battles is an interesting point. That might very well be part of why the game still looks pretty good. And you'll notice they didn't really change it for Mother 3. I mean, it looks exactly the same, pretty much.
Yeah.
It's a little more colorful in general, I think.
Seems to have worked for Pokemon, never changing battle animations.
Right.
Oh, black and white.
Black and white changes it somewhat.
Hold on there, it kind of zooms in a little bit now.
That's crazy.
It's funny to me that Steve compares Earthbound to Dragon Quest IX, which does have battle animation, because, of course, if you go back to the roots of the Dragon Quest series, all the way up through, I think, at least 6, if not 7, the battles looked exactly like Earthbound battles. They're first person, there's no character animation, you never see your character during battle. The enemies don't really move, they just kind of flash, they might have like 2 frames of animation. Very Pokemon. I mean, Earthbound and Pokemon are both derivative of Dragon Quest, the early Dragon Quest games. And when Dragon Quest VIII added the battle animation, you actually see your character run up and hit the enemy during battle. That was really controversial in Japan. I mean, this game came out in 2006 or something, and that was really controversial that you could actually see your characters animated during battle. But they still, if you notice, even in, not so much in 9, but certainly in 8, the battles will start in first person, to kind of as a callback to the early Dragon Quest games, and then the camera sort of pulls out, and you see everyone interacting more. And it's done really well in 9. It's just very dynamic-looking battles. They're a lot more fun to look at now, I think. But, you know, the animation will eventually age, and it's a question of how well it'll hold up in the future. But I just wanted to make that point. It was funny that he contrasted with Dragon Quest IX.
I think, really, the original Pokemon games actually still look pretty good. I mean, they're black and white, but, I mean, the sprites for them, they're not ugly. Well, the battles are, but the games themselves really aren't that bad.
Yeah.
And they've always tried to kind of retain the essence of that look.
Yeah.
Even on, even when they've gone polygonal.
It's so iconic.
Yeah, I think
they are trying to maintain that.
I think what they're doing with black and white is as far as they could get from it without it being heresy.
So I mean, haven't actually seen the examples from black and white, but what was weird to me about Pokemon, and it goes all the way back to the first games, but it always, the battle character art during battle, it's not even the lack of animation, that was obviously intentional, I think, part originally due to technical limitations, later intentional. But the weird thing is that the character art of the Pokemon themselves during battle always looked like it's been scaled out or like rotated from some original art.
They had, actually. That is exactly what happened.
But even in Diamond and Pearl on the DS, it still looks like that.
It actually was better in Gold and Silver than it was in the originals, and then it got worse.
Yeah. But it's really strange. It's like they clearly think that's part of the style.
So what you're seeing is the Pokemon drawn from the back, and I think it's a zoomed in image from the Pokédex.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think they originally did it because of art asset size.
Right, right.
And then they're just like, "Well, this is tradition now."
So anyway, I don't know if we totally addressed that question, but I hope we gave you some examples at least of games that may or may not hold up well over time.
Tetris may hold up over time. I'm not too sure.
No, that game's
Tetris does. Tetris Sphere, not so much. Looks really bad.
Yeah, generally, I think anything that's hinging on a certain visual effect or based on realism, generally.
Well, I think the Virtual Boy holds up really well. I think it looks just as good as it does then and as it does now. Well, that's technically not lying.
I agree. I agree, James.
I mean, a lot of it's sprite. Now, Red Alarm is unplayable. I mean, it's Battlezone and Star Fox without the paneling of Star Fox. So it's like Star Fox where you can see through shit.
It's wireframe Star Fox. Yeah,
it's chaos.
Oh, that sounds like a nightmare.
But stuff like Telerobaxer still looks really good, because it's all sprite layers. All
right, well, interesting. Maybe we'll come back in a couple of years and revisit this discussion and look at some of the things that we're playing now and see how they compare. I have a feeling that a lot of Wii games are going to look really bad in 5 years. I mean, they don't look great now, but come back in 5 years, and a lot of the 3D stuff on Wii is going to be really hard to look at, especially on all of our new TVs. As the TVs get better and better and better and better, that Wii stuff is going to look worse and worse.
See, when we have our 5D TV.
Yeah.
I mean, of the 3D stuff, I think only Galaxy has a chance of, you know, holding up.
Sure.
Galaxy's kind of like the Wii's Yoshi's Island, you know, which holds up so much better than DKC. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that is going to bring our show to a close. And before we go, first a reminder, the email address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We need your letters. We're getting low. There's a lot of stuff going on in the world of gaming. We're getting into the fall season. Metroid is out. So send us your letters. Let us know what you think. Give us questions, comments, ideas, whatever. We'll take it all. We'll read it on the show. Little reminder that the issue of EGM number 240 with my article about the ESRB is out. I got my copy in the mail today from subscription. So that means if you're subscribed, you should be getting it. And it should be out on newsstands now as well, I think. So I recommend it. It's a good issue. I've read the whole thing. And my part is, it turned out, I'm very happy with how it turned out. So if you have some feedback on that, let me know. I would definitely appreciate hearing your thoughts on it and your suggestions. We're going to get back into Retroactive pretty soon. Probably have something to say about that next week. We need to finalize some plans, select some games, figure out exactly what we're going to do with it. So listen back next week. And speaking of next week, we're going to have a special shorter episode. We'll be recording it probably on a different night. And it's all because of the NFL season, basically, right?
Yeah, last year I had the week off, one of my rare weeks off. Mm-hmm. And this would be my first week off since E3, but I'm giving it up to do a special shorter episode.
Yes. So we're probably going to have just two or three people, and we'll probably talk exclusively about Metroid and sort of follow up on that and sort of conclude the primary discussion of Metroid Other M. And then we might have a bonus segment where I do some kind of late game spoiler in-game stuff about Mother 3 and sort of put a bow on that.
This is the anti-James podcast, apparently.
Just sit back and enjoy the Saints defensive line trying to kill Brett Favre again.
All right, so look forward to that. It won't be a full two-hour extravaganza that you normally get, but we'll have something out for you, and then we'll be back to regular the week after that. That's all. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks to these guys for taking time out of their busy schedules to record with me, and we'll see you next week on Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye-bye.
Later. Bye.
This sounds exactly like a real massage.
Yeah, so what amazed me about it was the fact that it's 900 Wii points for it.
It is!
It's $9?
I thought it was 7.
No, I thought it was 7. It was 900 Wii points, and...
Oh my god.
Really, I mean, it is one of the simplest games I've ever played, and it's
really
funny because...
I really hope you're going to give something to the Pakistan flood charities now.
I know.
You bloody well better after spending good money on that.
Yeah, I was really surprised. I was amazed. I was like, that can't be the entire game. I'm actually going to... I have three more clients to play through. I'm going to actually do that to see if there is actually more to the game. It's funny because the game actually seems so shallow that I'm going to play all the way through all the content just to make sure that it is actually that shallow, because I can't believe it's actually that shallow. It's actually a brilliant game design, because I'm going to play this to see if it's as bad as I think it is.
You are going to review this, right? I think you at least need to
I think I
that.
Have to, yeah.
I think you do. I think it needs to be a video review.
I'm looking forward to the upcoming crossover between Enjoy Your Massage and Muscle March.
Yeah.
Natural. It's a natural fit.
Oh. Like, if you buy both of those, is there, like, an algorithm running on a server somewhere, like...
That puts you on the, like, national pedophile registry or whatever?
This guy not safe. It's like, it prevents you from adding
your
friend
codes.
John,
you do have both now, don't you?
Yeah, have, but yeah. They were both given to him, though. They're trying to set him up.
Yeah, they're setting me up.
Catch a predator.
It's like to catch a predator.
It prevents your Wii from adding any other Wii with parental controls enabled as a friend. Nope.
I'm just glad they don't do any like profiling based on the downloads on my Wii.
I would love to see what it would suggest to you.
WiiWare recommends Choaniki, 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 and Choaniki.
No, they know you've already bought that.
See, I'll pay good money for Choaniki.
You have to dig in a little deeper.
That's right. He's got Choaniki. Enjoy your massage and muscle march on
and
there.
Muscle march. Yeah, the trifecta.
His Wii is straining under the weight.
Yeah. I wonder what a Club Nintendo prize you get for having downloaded all three of those. It's a special award.
Oh, well, what's scary
I'm gonna have
is
to check.
Special award is you get kicked out of Club Nintendo.
Please note that Enjoy Your Massage is officially listed as being available for 500 Nintendo points. The mystery as to why James apparently overpaid for this game has yet to be solved.